Welcome to this episode of My Journey as a Physicist. Each episode features an interview with a physicist to learn about their work, their interests outside of physics, and their professional journey of how they ended up where they are today. Season 3 features physicists involved in the long-range plan for nuclear science. I hope you enjoyed today's episode. Welcome, I'm Bill Good, and I'm here with Kinza.
Hi, everyone. So today we have Professor Haiyan with us. Thank you for joining us. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, I'm happy to. I'm a physicist, and I'm a professor of physics at Duke University. And currently, I also have the role as the Associate Laboratory Director for Nuclear and Particle Physics at Brookhaven National Laboratory. I came to US as a graduate student, and I did my PhD in experimental nuclear physics. I have been at universities essentially all my life. I was for a year the staff scientist at Argonne National Laboratory. Since June 2021, I have been in my current position at Brookhaven National Lab, but I still hold my professorship at Duke University.
Yeah, that's great. Thank you for that information. So could you tell us a little bit about what your research is about?
So mostly what I'm working on or my interest has been in understanding the structure of nucleons, in this case, both neutrons and the protons. Maybe you are wondering why we care about the structure of the nucleons. And the reason we care is that we know that nucleons, neutrons, and protons, they are the building blocks of atomic nuclei. And atomic nuclei are essentially responsible for all the visible matter in the universe. And they are responsible for you and I, the way we are made up. And the theory about, you know, atomic nuclei is so-called quantum chromodynamics. And this is a beautiful theory, and it's extremely concise when you write down the Lagrangian. However, in the region energy scale where you and I live, we really cannot, or at least we are not able to analytically solve using Lagrangian. So what people have been doing, you know, they do computer simulations to simulate the theory on computers using very, very fast, powerful computers. They also do models. They also do phenomenologies. And in order to understand how quantum chromodynamics or QCD works, and nucleons, they provide an extremely important laboratory for us to really understand how the theory works in this kind of energy scale that we really cannot apply perturbative calculations to solve QCD. So my research really has been focusing on the nucleon structure. When we talk about the nucleon structure, that is another fascinating topic in the sense that it is very rich and also diverse. So we can talk about the internal charge distribution. We can talk about the magnetization distribution. We can talk about the spin distribution. We can talk about their momentum and even their mass composition. We can also talk about, you know, their flavor structure. And we can also talk about if I apply external electromagnetic field, how the neutron and proton will react. So it is a very, very rich topic. So for my PhD thesis, I worked on the magnetization distribution. And now in more recent times, my research interest has been focusing on understanding their three-dimensional image. Imagine you want to take a picture of the, you know, the quarks and gluons inside the nucleon, so-called tomography. So currently I'm interested in their internal three-dimensional structure because they will really help to uncover the very rich dynamics of the nucleon structure. And we wanted to understand that from the theory of QCD.
That's awesome. Thank you for illuminating these big questions that are remaining. So if you're coming from the experimental side, what kind of experiments are you interested in doing and interested in being a part of?
So I can tell you maybe about two experiments at the moment. One is we are using electron scatterings. I'm sure you have knowledge or may even have experience with a microscope in your biology class, maybe in high school, maybe in college. So you can think about, you know, the kind of physics I do is that we work with a very special microscope. It means that the resolution is, or the length scale we are probing is much, much smaller compared with the biological system. So we're looking at 10 to the minus 15 meter and much, much smaller than that. By the way, 10 to minus 15 meter, we call Fermi, and we are looking at the length scale smaller than that and also comparable to a Fermi. So why I mentioned this is that the size of the proton or the size of neutron, you know, just roughly, it is on the order of a Fermi. So one experiment I'm working on is trying to determine the size of the proton. And in this particular case, we are talking about the proton charge radius. So what do I mean by proton charge radius? If you can imagine, in undergraduate or physics 101, we talk about, you know, we have a static charge distribution. If I give you some kind of nice charge distribution, you can calculate different kind of properties, electromagnetic or related property of this piece of charge distribution. So in this case, when we talk about charge radius, we are talking about charge distribution weighted size. Okay, so that is what we meant by charge radius. So early on, I talk about electron scattering is like a microscope. So when we do scattering experiment, if I have a proton in the laboratory as my target, and I will incident electron beam onto this proton target, and electron will scatter from the proton, and I will measure the scattered electron. To determine the proton charge radius, we do on the kind of scattering called elastic scattering, means that I have electron coming in, electron scatter off the proton, and I have a proton in my laboratory as a target. And after the scattering, the proton remains as a proton, but it recoils, it moves in a different direction. So we can do this kind of elastic scattering to determine the proton charge radius. So you might be wondering, why do we care about the proton charge radius? There are two important reasons we care. One is that this is a quantity also related to the internal structure of the proton. So from what I introduced early about the theory of strong interaction QCD, as well as the structure of the proton, we wanted to measure this quantity precisely. Then we can compare with, we hope that in the future, lattice QCD calculation will give us a very precise prediction for the proton charge radius. But another important reason is that you are all familiar with hydrogen atom, right? That's the simplest atom is hydrogen atom. So in hydrogen atom, we have a proton, we have an electron, right, orbiting around the proton, which is the nucleus. And the proton charge distribution or the proton charge radius actually affects the hydrogen atomic energy levels. Okay, so if I can measure the proton charge radius very precisely, people can do very precise atomic spectroscopy measurement, and then they can compare with the most precise or theoretical calculation based on quantum electrodynamics. That will allow you to provide very high precision test of QED, which means that a precise measurement of the proton charge radius, it is also important to atomic physics, to quantum electrodynamics, ultra-high precision test. Another way to think about this is that you can also, using atomic measurement, using the best or state-of-the-art QED calculation, that will allow you to determine the charge radius of the proton from atomic method. Then you can compare electron scattering with atomic hydrogen measurement. In fact, people even do more exotic measurement, which is called muonic hydrogen measurement. So in this case, imagine hydrogen atom. It just looks like a regular hydrogen atom. The only difference is instead of having an electron in orbit, you have a muon in orbit. And muon is like a cousin to electron, which everything looks the same as electron, except it is about 200 times more massive than the electron. So in this case, when you do atomic measurement using a muonic hydrogen atom, and because the Bohr radius is so much smaller compared with ordinary hydrogen atom, so in this case, whatever you measure in terms of atomic transition, it is more sensitive to the proton charge distribution or the proton charge radius. So when people were successful in doing this kind of experiment using muonic hydrogen atoms, and they provided very high precision measurement, but then the value is significantly smaller than using ordinary hydrogen or using electron scattering. So this triggered major proton charge radius puzzle. So we actually did a very innovative new type of electron scattering experiment at Jefferson Lab, and we determined a proton charge radius value that is consistent with the muonic result. And I can keep going on and on, but I'm not going to do that. And if you are interested, I can, you know, send you guys a review article so that you can look at that later. But this is one experiment I wanted to share with you, which is elastic scattering means that we do not destroy the proton, and the proton remains as a proton. That's called elastic. Now, the other type of experiment we do is called inelastic. So in this case, I am going to vary my electron microscope so that the wavelength or the probe size is much, much smaller than one Fermi, which means it is much smaller than the typical size of the proton. So now this probe is going to look inside of the proton or neutron. So in this case, they're going to probe the partons, let's just say quarks inside. And the kind of experiment I do is called deep inelastic scattering. So not only I will detect scattered electron in this case, I will also detect, because now I'm going to destroy the proton. Okay, so the proton is no longer elastic process. So imagine the probe is able to couple to a quark inside the proton, and I will follow this quark. And the quark cannot be free, means that you cannot detect a free quark in the laboratory, and this quark will find, you know, other quarks or antiquarks to become a hadron. So in this part, I will detect a leading hadron, pion, for example, coming out of this process together with the scattered electron. And this kind of measurement is called semi-inclusive deep inelastic scattering. And by doing this kind of measurement, I am able to probe or determine the three-dimensional momentum of the quarks inside the neutron or proton. So that will give us the kind of three-dimensional tomography of the quarks inside the nucleon in three-dimensional momentum space. So these are the two kind of experiments I have been working on in more recent years. And I just wanted to say that the so-called semi-inclusive deep inelastic scattering experiment, this kind of measurement will be a very important part of the future electron-ion collider program.
Thank you. That was a wide variety of information, but it was also very clear. And I really like to hear about like the interplay between different experiments and stuff. So what is a typical day like for you? And one specific question I wanted to ask is also, you know, you're lab director at BNL and you also have a professor position at Duke. So where are you spending your days and how do those two interplay?
Very interesting and good question. So just one correction, my position is associate laboratory director for nuclear particle physics. So currently I have a joint appointment with Duke University and BNL. And let me just use the short name, which is they like to call me ALD, which is the shorthanded notation for associate laboratory director, which is mouthful. So ALD here, so for my responsibilities here, the Nuclear Particle Physics Directorate at the lab is a very large organization. So we have three major programs on nuclear physics. A relativistic heavy ion collider is a very important part of the nuclear physics. And we have a nuclear theory program. And we have high energy physics here. And high energy physics is the third largest program at the laboratory. The largest one is RIC, Relativistic Heavy Ion Program. And then we have a light source program, which is the next second largest, and then high energy physics. And then in my organization, we also have an isotope research and production. And just last week, or I should say just about 9 days ago, very exciting. So the isotope research and production program became its own department. So currently in my organization, we have a physics department, we have collider accelerator department, we have isotope research and production department. So the entire organization has about 700 employees. So a typical day here is always exciting. And you always feel like you need more hours each day and you need more days per week. So RIC, you probably know. And this is a facility that is unique in the sense it is the only one which can collide heavy ions at high energies and also collide polarized proton and proton. So why that is important? It is important Rick is able to recreate so-called a mini band. You know, you have heard Big Band, and Rick is able to create, you know, the kind of very special matter called quark gluon plasma, which is a deconfined quark gluon matter. And that was believed to exist like on the order of microseconds after the Big Bang. And you can create this kind of special matter to study. And that helps us to understand how strong interaction, how the theory QCD really works. At the same time, when we collide polarized proton, unpolarized proton, that allows us to study the important question like, what is the role of gluon spins when it comes to the proton spin? And proton-proton collision will also allow us to probe the three-dimensional structure, as I introduced early, about the quarks and gluons inside the proton. And just recently, we brought a new collider detector online, which is called S-Phoenix. So this is a detector which will allow us to use very precise probe to really understand the detail of the quark-gluon plasma. At RIC, and later confirmed by LHC, one of the very major discoveries made at RIC is that the quark gluon plasma behaves like a perfect fluid. And this was something quite surprising to many. And with the S-Phoenix detector, it was designed to really probe and address the question how, you know, this quark interaction mediated by the gluon, this kind of interaction will give us a structureless near perfect fluid. And this is the important goal of S-Phoenix. And our, you know, current plan is that we will finish the RIC science mission in terms of data taking in 2025, and then RIC ring will be converted into the Hadron ring for the electron-ion collider. Let me just also say a couple words about high energy physics. We are the lead lab for the US ATLAS collaboration for the ATLAS experiment at LHC at CERN. And we are also the lead lab for the US Bell-2 program in Japan. And our colleagues are also playing a very important role in a very major undertaking led by Fermilab. This is the long baseline neutrino experiment called LBNF-DOOM. I would like to mention that we also have a small yet vibrant astrophysics and cosmology program. We also have highly impactful and visible theory program in both nuclear physics and high energy physics. Our theory colleagues collaborate closely with experimental colleagues, providing support and guidance of our experimental programs. And our isotope research and production program is extremely important for the nation. As you probably know, isotope has enormous usage in medical diagnosis and also cancer treatments, as well as industry, national security, and many other applications. So my typical day involves a lot of challenges and a lot of meetings and a lot of communications and a lot of report reading and writing and working with colleagues, you know, overcoming different challenges. And also, as Rick is currently the largest nuclear physics of DOE Office of Science nuclear physics program user facility. So we have users right now, about 900 users. Used to be much, much larger when Rick had more experiments running at the same time. And so I also interact with a lot of Rick users and interact with the program advisory committee. And BNL is one of the host laboratories for the electron-ion collider. So I also interact with the electron-ion collider users a lot. And for my other life at Duke, currently I have 10% of effort for my Duke program. And I don't teach because I don't have time to teach, but I have a research group. So I work with PhD students, I work with my postdocs. And before I was talking to you, you know, I also do service for Duke. So currently I serve as Duke University's Distinguished Professor Review Committee. So I was reading a lot of fascinating nominations and reading a lot of book review, which is actually quite nice for physicists. You know, you don't read physics paper, you read something else, which I always enjoy, the kind of different intellectual endeavors.
Thank you so much for summarizing all of that beautifully. So I have a follow-up question. You mentioned that you are the ALD for BNL. So how does that role sort of differ from a university admin position? And how do you sort of make that transition?
That's a fascinating, great question. In fact, I also served as university administrator. I don't know how much you have done your homework. So I was department chair for a few years, and then I served as the founding vice chancellor for academic affairs at Duke Kunshan University, and which is a brand new university now, no longer brand new in the sense that the university just celebrated 10th anniversary. So my position there at the new university was equivalent to a provost position. So I have, you know, the academic administrator experience. So now for my ALD, I would say that there are several major differences. So one is that at university, you work with faculty, students, and staff, right? So students are a very important part. You work on academic programs. So here, I do not directly work with so many students here in my current role, but in our user group, we have a lot of students. So indirectly, I work with students, and directly, students came here, you know, whether they are here for their research or for summer programs. I also interact with students, but not so much directly on academic program. But when it comes to research, that is, you know, I, as an ALD for my job at BNL, I do not, you know, directly have a student on the research program here, but my work is really to enable other people's success with their research, whether they are users, students, or faculty from university coming to BNL for their work, or my colleagues here as a staff scientist or engineers. So another major, very large difference is that I now, in my current role, I interact with funding agencies a lot more. So as a university PI, I work with the program manager, right, who is the person I interact a lot because they give me the award, right? So I report to them in terms of my progress report and also submit to DOE about grant applications. So here for the BNL, whether it's a nuclear particle isotope program, I interact with the corresponding program office at the Department of Energy in Office of Science. And that involves, you know, nuclear physics and high energy physics and isotope program. So these are the three offices I do interact with, and particularly nuclear physics because of RIC and also because of EIC. And then we also here at BNL, we have NASA Space Radiation Laboratory, which has been founded. We just celebrated, and today is October 9th, and October 14th, we will be celebrating the 20th anniversary of the Space Radiation Lab supported by NASA. And now Missile Defense Agency, which is a part of DOD, and they also support research for electronic testing for, you know, those electronic will be used in for the space exploration. So I also interact with NASA as well as MDA, you know, for the kind of research they support using the facility at Brookhaven National Lab. So that is another major difference. And of course, here I work with a lot of staff scientists. And National Lab overall, you know, it is mission driven. So there is a specific mission. So you are very focused to, you know, meet the mission. And university, it is, you know, it's a more educational institution, and it's more you work with students. So intellectually, as university professors, you have different kind of freedom. You can think about ideas. I hope that makes sense to you.
Yeah, definitely. Thank you. How would you explain to graduate or undergraduate students what your roles and involvements were in the long-range plan?
Very, very good question. So long-range plan, this is something nuclear physics has been doing for many years. So the community started to do long-range plan in 1979. So that almost 45 years, right? So it's actually very, very interesting in the sense that when you look at the 1979 long-range plan, and I'm trying to remember, I think that was correct. At some point, I may have seen a cover of the report, and it was, you know, all typed down by the typewriter, right? It's a very, very small number of names for the planning. And I seem to recall I have seen a photo somewhere. So it's just very few people involved. If you go back to look at nuclear physics paper in the 70s, you know, it's a much smaller number, whether it's a theory or experiment. And theory paper usually has small number of authors, but sometimes, you know, when you do a very computing intensive kind of work like lattice QCD, and the number of people involved are much larger. But maybe we can use experiment as a reference. The reason I mentioned this is nowadays the experiment are becoming more complex. And the other way you can think about is as we learn more, flaw, right? The kind of problem we want to attack. If they are simple, they were solved already, right? So now you actually really need to develop more advanced, sophisticated experimental apparatus to solve some of the big important questions that also require a larger collaboration. So coming back to long-range plan, the community has been doing the planning every 5-7 years. And just to lay out the vision and lay out the priorities, you know, what are the important questions we want to solve? And what kind of facilities and tools we need to build or develop? And what kind of resources, you know, of course, the resources are not blue sky, right? Because our research has been funded by the federal government. And so usually the planning committee was given a charge by DOE and NSF, National Science Foundation, with different funding scenario. So you actually lay out the scientific vision and the kind of instrumentation and new tools and the techniques you want to build, you want to develop. At the same time, you also want to look at the funding scenario to see how you can actually present a compelling vision and with a priority. You also always look at the, you know, the workforce, which is also very important. So this has been very successful over the years. And for example, CBAF, which is Jefferson Lab, which is CBAF is Continuous Electron Beam Accelerator Facility. And we just mentioned to you about RIP. And then you guys are from Michigan State University, so you know FRIP very well. So all these facilities were built over the years through this planning, the kind of vision we laid out, the kind of priority the community articulated. And the electron ion collider is part of the, you know, this vision as well.
Thank you. So what specific roles have you had in the long range plan over the years?
I was part of the writing committee in 2015. And then I think in 2007, I became more involved. One thing I wanted to comment on that I think you probably noticed as well in more recent time, which has been a very positive development. We engage, you know, more early career or mid-career colleagues to be part of the process. Because if you think about long-range plan, it is really for the future, right? So therefore, it makes a lot of sense for people who have a lot to say and who have, you know, decades of their career ahead of them, right, to be a very important part of the planning. And I think that I became more involved, started with the 2007 long range plan by attending town hall meetings, contributing to the white paper writing. So that was 2007. And then 2015, I was even more involved because I was part of the writing committee. I was one of the convener for the QCD town hall meetings. And later I became the writing committee member, which means that as a convener for the town hall meeting, which means I work with other people, really put together the program, coordinate the writing of the white paper, like reflected the importance of the QCD field, and later being part of writing committee, not only attending the meeting of the writing committee and also read all the white papers. So making sure our writing reflects the science priority articulated by the QCD community. And then in the 2023, the current long range plan. And I actually have multiple hats because currently I am the chair of the Division of Nuclear Physics Executive Committee of the American Physical Society, DNP. In the long range plan, DNP has always been responsible for organizing the town hall meetings. So last year, the Professor Vicky Green, she was chair of DNP. I became chair this April. So now she's the past chair. So she played a very important role in leading the organization of the town hall meeting. Of course, town hall meetings were organized by local organizing committees with program committees, but DNP served a very important role to lead and also help and support. In the 2023 long-range plan process, so I became the DNP chair after all the town hall meeting already completed because the chair term is 1 year. So last year I was chair-elect. This year I'm chair. Next year, Professor Ding Li will be the chair. I will be the past chair. So we worked closely as a chair line. And then currently I serve as an ex-official in my role as the DNP chair on the National Nuclear Science Advisory Committee. study called ANSAC, and then I am part of the writing committee. So we have members, about 60 members, who worked very hard on the long-range plan. I was asked to serve as a chair for one of the chapters, which is the facility chapters of the long-range plan, and also contributed together to the QCD as well as other reports. It took many months of many, many people's hard work. So I work with a lot of people very closely, as well as working with colleagues here at BNL, because some of the nice images and figures came from colleagues' work here from our communications team, in addition to our scientists' contribution. And this is the same for other members who serve on the committee. They also got a lot of help from their colleagues at their institutions.
Thank you for that description. That was really nice to hear. Now that the long-range plan is publicly available as of like the beginning of October, could you describe some of the big impacts that you think are going to occur?
Oh, that's a very big question. I think that one big impact, this report, I'm certainly very, very hopeful, is that like any other long-range plan, we conveyed a very compelling science. And also we talk about the U.S. Leadership in nuclear science. This particular report also articulated very, very clearly, not only the nuclear physics is a field with enormous discovery potential and discovery opportunities, and we also articulated clearly a very compelling picture of the broad benefits nuclear physics, nuclear science, and nuclear scientists, researchers, students, and staff have contributed to the U.S. in terms of technological innovation breakthrough, which led to applications to many, many fields that benefits people in the society, and also the workforce. U.S. nuclear science contributed to the nation because nuclear scientists who are very much in high demand by many professions. This is the kind of compelling picture. And then, of course, we also put a very compelling science opportunity with the electron-ion collider and also with neutrinoless double beta decay experiment, as well as other strategic initiative. And the highest priority was to take advantage of the investment the country has made in nuclear science and continue to be a leader in nuclear science.
That's awesome. Good to hear that we think we've actually laid them out nicely in the long-range plan and everyone can read them now.
So when exactly did you decide to become a physicist and why in the first place?
I think it was in middle school, maybe even before middle school, because my father, he's not a physicist. He's not even very, you know, scientific or technical in the sense, because he studied literature. But somehow he was always impressed by famous female physicists. So Madame Wu, C.S. Wu, and Madame Curie, and they became my role models. And so I was grew up listening to their stories and my dad's encouragement, even though he's not scientific himself. And I also have very, very good science teacher, particularly physics teacher. And one of them, my high school physics teacher, is a woman. And so I think that because my role model and because my physics teacher, so it just seemed to be very natural for me to consider to become a physicist.
That's really awesome. I think that's really cool that you were inspired by, you know, women in physics as great role models. Maybe on a similar note, could you comment on any obstacles that you had to overcome, whether it was due to being a woman or maybe being an international student in the US or anything like that?
Yeah, I think that for me, my mother, she, of course, now she retired many years ago, but she was always working. And so I was actually in a daycare when I was about 2 months old. And my mother's company had an on-site daycare. And also another interesting thing was, you know, it's, I don't know, now I can say interesting, but it was very tough in the sense that my parents, you know, they're still married and they have always been married, but they were working in two different cities, which were separated by 36-hour train ride. You probably have never heard, right? So it was tough. I spent 1 year with my mom in northern part of China, 1 year with my dad. So I was kind of alternating between these two cities very far away. But my mother was able to work because of daycare. So to me, the major shock coming to US was that, you know, very few daycare. And even there were at that time when I needed And even when there were on-site daycare, as a graduate student, I was not able to afford. So I actually became a mother when I was a graduate student. And he will be 31 later this month. And he's a medical doctor. And I had my son when I was a graduate student. So to me, the largest obstacle was how you actually balance. As you probably know, PhD student, experimental PhD student, sometimes we had to travel far away to do experiment. And it was not easy. And so I think that was, and later when I was assistant professor and my son was young and I needed to travel. And so those were very, very difficult. But I also had very, very kind people helping me. Very briefly, my advisor at Caltech, and he told me that pursuing a PhD was already very, very difficult. And becoming a parent is also something very difficult. And you are trying to do two very difficult things at the same time. But we're going to do whatever we can to help you. So that really meant a lot. Another quick story was that when my son was young, during 1 year when I was at the Argonne National Lab, we needed to do an experiment at Indiana University. And I needed to bring my son to the lab to Indiana on a weekend, you know, to work on experiment. So I was looking for preschool. And I reached out to a preschool. And later on, I realized that the preschool opened just on weekend, just for my son. Okay. And they did not overcharge me either. They just charged whatever reasonable. And the preschool director and the vice director, the two of them actually were taking care of my son, just one kid. So I think that was, you know, in many ways, it was difficult. But at the same time, I always feel so blessed, you know, have this kind of support.
That's incredibly impressive, and that's very inspiring. It is wonderful to hear about, you know, the kindness of other people and helping you through that. I cannot imagine being a PhD student and having a child. So I commend you.
Thank you. Now, of course, that was all in the past, but, you know, it was not easy at the time.
Yeah. On that note, do you have any advice for young researchers or young students that might be going through a similar situation?
I think that the important thing is, one is you need to like what you're working on, right? Passionate. And then the second thing I remember is balancing is such a beautiful word. And it's also always very difficult to strike the right balance, right? So you have to tell yourself there is no perfect solution. And there's no like a formula which will be successful if you adopt this particular formula. And I remember, you know, when I was busy with everything, my son was growing up, I always felt guilty compared with other mothers who have more time, right? And I was not able to spend, you know, as much time as I would have liked. But at the same time, I think one should not underestimate the kind of impact and influence one has on their children. And I remember, you know, my son was always hardworking. He does certain things, you know, very organized. And also he decided independent of me to have physics as his undergraduate major. And I think there are, you know, certain, we talk about role model, right? And I think parents are role models to their children. What you do also set example to children. And when you try to balance, I told my son when he was growing up, I told him that work was important to me, but he was more important. If he needs me, and I would drop what I'm doing and then just come to him. And obviously when, you know, when he just goes to school, everything's fine, you know, I have to do a very good job with my work. You need to be passionate. You do need to balance, but you also need to recognize that you are a human being and you cannot do everything perfectly. And I think one other thing, communication is so important. So I always communicate with my son when he was, you know, 4 or 5 years old. I started to treat him as an adult and we will have a very equal kind of conversation. And I think that's also important. And tell him that you have your own weakness, which is also important.
Yeah, thank you so much. Okay, so shifting gears a little bit, what do you do to relax? Do you have any specific hobby or something that you do when you're not doing physics or research?
Yeah, I actually have a lot of hobbies, but I just don't have time. And my hobby also changes over the years. So currently, you know, my hobby is gardening. I used to cook a lot. I really like to cook. But now with COVID, with my work at B&L, my kitchen in Durham, North Carolina, is falling apart. So I really do very simple cooking. Also, I don't have time. But I like to read and I like to write and I like music and I like walk. So walking and gardening at this moment are the two most relaxing things for me. But of course, here at the lab, I cannot really do gardening. But whenever I go back to Duke, which is about once a month, and I try to do gardening just to relax myself, you know, like weeding and moving plants around. But I do like to read and listening to music as well. I don't have too much time to read non-physics stuff, but these days. By the way, I forgot to ask you, Kinza and Bill, can you just say like a few words about yourself?
So I am a sophomore. I'm currently studying physics.
Wonderful. And Bill?
Yeah, I'm a second-year grad student at MSU. Both me and Kinza are working under Dr. Lin in Lattice QCD. So.
Okay, very good. And I know Dr. Lin for many years.
Thank you so much for this wonderful interview. It was great to have you.
You're welcome. And I enjoy talking to you guys. You guys are very professional and you do everything very well.
Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed today's episode. This podcast was created by Brian Stanley and Professor Huiwin Lin. This episode was hosted by Bill Good and Kinza Hassan, edited by Esther Cohen Lin. Thanks for listening.